Interview with Gene Rotberg, May 14th, 2007, in Washington, D.C., by Kenneth Durr.
Well, I want to start with background.
Okay.
Looks to me like you must be from Philadelphia.
Yes, I am.
So, did you go straight from Penn to the SEC?
I went to the Army, then the SEC, okay. Yes. So, right after law school, I went to the commission. Oh, I worked for 6 months for a lawyer running some errands, but my first professional job was at the commission.
When you were studying at Penn, did you know you wanted to get into corporate law or securities law?
No, I was much more interested in civil rights and civil liberties issues. My father was a lawyer, and I didn't think that I would be going to the SEC at all. By some accident, I heard that there was a potential opening at the commission. I went down to the commission, met Manny Cohen, and Manny hired me on the spot.
Now, was he head of a division at that point?
He was at that time either the director of corporate finance or the associate director.
Okay.
It turned out that he had just come back from a year sabbatical, I think a Rockefeller Foundation grant. And in the interim, there were some political appointees, and he was not sure what his authority was when he came back to the commission after his sojourn overseas. I walked into his office. He asked me whether I was a lawyer. I said yes. He said, let me see now if I have the power to hire and fire. He came back a few moments later and said, you're hired.
Who did he go to ask if he had the power?
Barney Woodside.
Okay. He might have been director of Corp Fin.
I think he was director of Corp Fin at the time. And that I went into corporate finance and began, as most young lawyers do, to work on registration statements and proxy statements.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about that process. That sounds like some of the less glamorous work at the
SEC. What it was the training ground to examine registration statements, proxy statements, and accounting statements when companies file it for disclosure. And the job of the lawyer, as well as the accountants there, was to examine the documentation and to see that there was full and complete disclosure. It was routine. It was, on the other hand, quite thorough, and it gave most of the lawyers a great deal of background in corporate finance and disclosure. At a certain point, of course, when the disclosure was deemed to be not only inadequate, but deliberately false and misleading, that then shifted the matter into an investigatory stage, whether there was either a civil or criminal potential activity. And indeed, that is what happened in several cases that I had.
How can you tell whether you've got full or complete disclosure on the face of it? You'd think that these registration statements would be, you know, geared toward slipping through the eyes of the unsuspecting.
What happens is that you see a disclosure which, or you hear from the street, or you read about an event that has occurred which is not consistent with what the formal disclosure is. And for example, I remember reviewing the Chrysler proxy statement, and it came to our attention, and I do not remember the source, that the son of the then president of Chrysler was providing on a sole source contract some material to Chrysler, which would have been a material event. That then led to an inquiry, an investigation, and on the grounds that the proxy statement did not disclose that potential conflict of interest. even had occasion to subpoena Juan Trippi and all the other directors, many of the other directors.
Was that Pan Am?
Who was then at Pan Am, mm-hmm. Concerning what he knew and what they knew about the secret holding of the son of the president of Chrysler in a company which had a sole source contract to provide a major portion of the Chrysler car, which was not disclosed in the proxy statement. That was rather typical. In another case, and this is more relevant to, I think, the subject you're interested in, I was assigned to what they then called Regulation A, which was the registration statements for very small issues. These were companies which were raising as little as $300,000 for the first time they were going public. The disclosures were rather straightforward, but what I noticed, and indeed my colleague and I noticed, is that for scores of those companies, the stock would be, say, registered to come out at $8 a share. The first day of trading, it would be $16 a share. Or the stock was registered to come out at 10. The first day of trading, it traded at 20. And that opened up our interest in determining, first, why that would happen, how it would happen, the circumstances under which a company would so apparently underprice their issues, and that opened up for myself and a colleague, Fred Moss, the whole question of what was entitled hot issues.
Are you still in your entry job here, reviewing?
I would say it's in the first two or three years of the commission.
And how do you get from the position where essentially you're sitting at a desk churning paper mm-hmm. to the point at which you're able to take something like this and really study it and devote your time to something like that?
I think what begins to happen is that as you become more proficient in doing the routine matters, you bring to your superior, in that case, in my case, it was Manny Cohen or Barney Woodside, a strange phenomena that you see occurring rather frequently, which raises policy questions, the hot issue being a typical one. They then ask the commission for the authority to do simply a private inquiry or investigation. Or they may assign you a research project to do an analysis of what happened or what happens, for example, in the hot issue, to see whether it is an ad hoc that only occurs very rarely or whether it is widespread. And, of course, if the matter is widespread, then it may be raised to either injunctive relief, criminal relief, or simply fact-finding. The hot issue became, and I think you may have seen a memorandum that I early wrote asking for permission to look into this matter for what were then perhaps 30 or 40 companies whose price stock went up between 50% and 150% within a millisecond after it went public, and to see whether or not there were any violations of the Securities Acts. We would receive a registration statement which raised issues which involve a public figure. For example, the commission had a registration statement for a company called Canadian Javelin that I was working on. And it was fraught with disclosure problems concerning the rights to various minerals in Newfoundland, which were given to this company. We made some inquiries as to why the principals of the company got these rights. The matter became quite controversial. An investigation was opened up, and it turned out that the premier of Newfoundland, Joey Smallwood, had granted these rights and had, according to our analysis, apparently received some private payments for granting these rights, which were run through some Swiss banks. That then opened up a major investigation, and the matter was at one point then referred to the Canadian Royal Mounted Police for fraud investigation of the premier. So that the staff would follow up leads, and sometimes it was narrow, like the one I've just described. Sometimes it related to the market, like the hot issue in matter. And all this occurred in the first, I would say, 3 years of my staying at the commission. And by the early 1960s, I was no longer doing the registration statement review, but I was involved in matters dealing with investigatory matters, adversarial matters, matters dealing with fraud or manipulation of the market, or, in the case of hot issues, the structure of how the market worked. And that, in turn, permitted me and one or two other colleagues to evaluate, not necessarily for purposes of injunction or criminal relief, how a market functioned, in this case, the over-the-counter market.
Did your hot issues lead to the over-the-counter market?
Yes, that's precisely how it led to it. And it meant that we then got subpoena power from the commission to talk to the market makers. What do you do? How do you function? Why are these prices doubling? What are the deals that are being made with the company, with the amongst the underwriters? What's the relationship between the managing underwriter and the aftermarket people? What's the relationship between the underwriters and their clients and their customers as to whether they are allowed to sell immediately? Who gets these so-called hot issues initially?
Were you talking to the brokers?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
What did they think of you coming in and grilling them like that?
Well, that's interesting. The commission, up to that point, had very little personal contact. This is, keep in mind, the late 1950s, early 1960s, with the street. Particularly if these were matters of policy or how the street worked. We assured them, which was the fact, that in the case of, for example, the hot issue, we were not interested in some kind of punishment or injunctive or criminal relief. We simply wanted to know how the market worked. And sometimes these discussions, for the most part, they occurred not under oath, but just going up to New York and having meetings with them. And you may have read on a number of occasions the meeting of Fred Moss and I, first with Morgan Stanley, when we went up and talked to them about hot issues.
I've heard about that peripherally.
Right. Well, it's a story that's told and it's been exaggerated somewhat.
Well, you can give me the real story then.
The real story was that no one, as far as we knew, had been to Morgan Stanley for decades. In fact, the contact was very minimal. The last contact being when Morgan testified at the PCOR hearings in the early 1930s. And a meeting was set up with my colleague, Fred Moss, and I, to go to Morgan Stanley, frankly, because they were not involved in these hot issues. They were then a very elite investment banking brokerage firm, and they would rarely bring these small issues to market. They would never be the managing underwriter. So we thought we would interview them and talk to them about this phenomena, which was getting a great deal of publicity, and if they could give us some insights whether they thought it was good practice or wise practice. So Fred and I went up to New York, and it was quite a meeting. We were ushered by men who were dressed in livery, in red coats and white stripes, to their offices, and the doors opened to an extremely large room. And in one far corner of the room was sitting someone, and he was sitting underneath a huge portrait of J.P. Morgan. And then there was someone directly in front of us, someone to the far left, someone immediately on each of the four corners. And when the doors opened, and no one said anything. And this voice came from beyond, from the desk, and said, "Who are you?" And I said, "My name is Gene Rotberg. As you know, a meeting has been set up. I'm from the SEC. This is my colleague, Fred Moss." And there was a pause. And he asked again, "Who are you?" And I think I repeated it, and they asked a third time. And finally, the man behind the desk said, "Let me tell you what I mean. My name is Perry Hall, managing partner Morgan Stanley, Princeton." And then he pointed to someone else and said, "Hudson Lemkow, partner, Morgan Stanley, underwriting." Then he pointed to another far corner and he said, "My name, John Petito, partner, Morgan Stanley, research, Princeton." And he pointed to someone else, somewhat elderly gentleman, I think it was John Young. He said, "Partner, Morgan Stanley, Williams." And he was captain of the football team. Well, you can imagine how terrified we both were. We had never been to Morgan Stanley. No one from the commission had been there. We were simply overwhelmed. And the story goes that I said, that Fred Moss said, "The name is Moss, M-O-S-S. And before that, it was Moskowitz." Brooklyn College Law School. Now, what I have added as a twist that he also then went on to say, "And before it was Moskowitz, it was Morgan." And in 1933, we changed it from Morgan to Moskowitz. That last part never happened, of course, but he did say that before that it was Moskowitz and Brooklyn College Law School. I then said, "We from the SEC, we came here because of potential fraud in the securities markets, and we thought that this was the best place to start. That sort of broke the ice, and later in the meeting at Perry Hall, told us his experience with hot issues, that his housekeeper, which was unknown to us, went to him one day and said, "I'm making a fortune in the stock market." And she said, "Well, how is that?" And she says, "I buy these stocks at $8 and they go to $15 the next day." He said, "Well, how do you get the stocks?" And she says, "Well, I would just call them on the phone and say to them, I see this security is coming out. This is Ms. So-and-so from Perry Hall's residence of Morgan Stanley. And they gave me the stock, or they sold me the stock." Well, later, of course, we became we discussed the matters with them, and they were very, very helpful. And later, of course, I became quite I had many relationships with the firm because of my later activities as the treasurer of the World Bank.
Right.
So we look back upon those early years with a great deal of humor and pleasure. But that was a typical interview, and they were helpful. And then we went to firms who actually were doing the transactions. But that led for me anyway, the interest on how markets worked. So that we began to look extensively at the operations of the over-the-counter market. We did receive from the commission the right to conduct the studies, and we were well on our way to examining the way the over-the-counter market functioned, not only for right after new issues came to market, but how the over-the-counter market functioned in general. At the same time that that was going on, just about the same time, I think, Dave Silver was working on Jerry Ray and the activities on the American Stock Exchange, how the stock exchange were working. So those two threads, if you will, were becoming very visible, not just in the street, but within the commission itself. And for the first time, the commission began to focus not so much on corporate disclosure, but on the way markets worked. The information that began to be developed by the staff, which was, of course, being brought to the commission, it began to become publicized. And, of course, very shortly thereafter, the special study was formed to formalize these private inquiries which had been ongoing. Myself with the over-the-counter market and Dave with the American Stock Exchange.
Can we back up just a little bit? These studies that you're doing, your initial over-the-counter study, Silver study, and Amex, I mean, Amex clearly, you know, that hit the front pages and there's a lot of reason for a study. Was Gadsby still chairman at this time?
I think so.
Yeah, because I always understand that the special study was really sort of ginned up by Kerry coming in and everything being new and this new energy to the commission.
I think that's right. That's right.
But it sounds like there was some energy.
Oh, there was energy before, and it was basically being driven by not just the commission, but the directors of the divisions, because the staff was very strong, and there was no political agenda at all involved in any of this. The great, as you may know, I don't want to jump ahead too far, this was a congressionally mandated special study.
Right.
That was extremely important, as it later turned out, because the subpoena power came from, therefore, from Congress to the special study, not from the five politically appointed commissioners. It also meant that the study, as it turned out, would be sent to Congress by the special study. And although the commission would get it first and they could make comments, we agree to this recommendation, we disagree to this recommendation, we're neutral, they did indeed make written comments to the study, to Congress. They did not at any time have control over what the study said. That was Milt Cohen and his staff. And what happened was when Milt came in, he saw these two major things going on with Dave and myself, and then he wisely did two different things. He added to it matters dealing with the investment companies, matters dealing with automation, matters dealing with marketing, sales practices, the whole panoply, not just the over-the-counter market and the operations of the stock exchange. The second thing that he did is we were rather young lawyers. Milt, at the time even, was a very sophisticated partner in a law firm, and he wisely brought in two or three senior people who would supervise the lawyers who were doing the work. He also brought in, we also hired a number of other lawyers. I would say, though, there were probably a half a dozen of us, maybe four or five, from the commission, and then others were brought in from outside.
He Who also, were some of those senior people?
Ralph Saul. I'm just trying to think. Yeah, I think Ralph Saul was not then at the commission. Dick, from a New York law firm, was number two, and I'll remember his name later.
Sure.
He brought in, I think, Bob Mundine. He brought in a very, very bright young lawyer, Roy Shotland, who did much of the rewriting, was a superb writer, Dal, I think, teaches at Georgetown Law School.
Had you gotten anywhere with your over-the-counter study before the special study kicked in? Had there been any results?
Yes, we knew what was, we knew what the issues were. But again, it was focused on hot issues.
Okay.
We had established relationships with perhaps a dozen firms where they trusted us and we trusted them. And we were focusing mostly on issues dealing with selective use of giving manipulation by blocking all sales in the first several weeks. And therefore, if there were only two or three buyers, the stock would double on virtually no volume. In other words, it was a control over the sale by saying to customers, you're not allowed to sell.
You create a shortage.
And they created, therefore, a shortage, so virtually no buying would double the price. The second thing that happened is the people who got the stock were friends and had very close ties with the NASD member, the major underwriter. There was also some evidence that these people who got the stock gave kickbacks to their underwriter, and in other cases, even the firms that were members of the syndicate had special deals with the managing underwriter that we'll do this for you if you give us the stock. There was also evidence that the stock was not even sold to the public. It was just kept by, in some cases, by the manager. All of which raised issues. But the important part is we learned how the over-the-counter market worked. And we began to see how that functioned. But we did not have, and then we had issues dealing with markups. That is, since the trades are principal trades in the over-the-counter market, they were often non-disclosed compensation. In other words, the bid and ask might be 15 bids, 16 ask, and the firm would charge 18. And say you're getting it at 18, there's no commission. Well, in fact, there's a huge compensation by the markup. And it was that kind of rather routine issues, those kinds of issues came up. It was not until, though, we had the mandate to do the chapters in the over-the-counter market that we began to look at normal, what I call, for want of a better term, aftermarket or secondary market trading, just as my other colleagues were working on the trading on the stock exchanges. And then, of course, what happened is we began to become aware of the existence of something called the third market, which was the over-the-counter market, functioning like the over-the-counter market for listed stocks, which we also began to examine during the special study. And then this is the early 1960s.
Was Whedon?
Yes, and Whedon was the key, and M.A. Shapiro in bank stocks.
Yes, Shapiro.
I don't know if you know that M.A. Shapiro, Morris Shapiro, a delightful person, that his... He has great fame in Wall Street to this day, but his brother has even greater fame. His brother is the famous art historian at Columbia, Shapiro, who is, you know, world known as a art historian, art critic. He died recently.
Well, we'll get to Shapiro. Right. I want to talk about this special study, though, and
yes,
sort of go into that. Sounds to me like it was probably assumed that you were going to have a part in this study.
Yes, I will. Yes, I mean, I was assigned the over-the-counter market piece.
Right.
And I had three or four lawyers working with me and two or three financial analyst types.
How did you structure your part of the shop?
Well, I never paid very much attention to organization or management. What I did is Dick Meyer and I, who was my closest colleague, said, "We've got to find out how this market works." And we simply scheduled private interviews. We would go up to New York, and we would see perhaps two firms a day, sometimes under oath, sometimes not under oath. Tell me what you do for a living. You get up in the morning and you go to your desk. Tell me about that desk. And what's on the desk? Who do you have lines to? Who do you deal with? Who do you clear with? How do you finance yourself? And we would talk to them by the hour. That is, for hours upon hours upon hours. And the first question we would ask of the first interviewee would be a very naive. By the second or third interview, we would know a great deal. By the fourth and fifth interview, we didn't know as much as the firm we were talking to, but we knew how another firm did it. And therefore, we knew more about how the whole street functioned than any one firm did. And then we asked to watch the traders on the telephone. We asked to look at who they had lines to, who paid for the lines, how they decided to record their transactions, who recorded the transactions, why they changed their bid and asked, how they knew who to trust, how fast did they communicate, if at all, with their competitors, as to an overhanging block that was being sold in the market. Well, we may have interviewed as many as 10 or 15 pure over-the-counter market makers who had no institutional or retail sales force, but were purely market makers. What became obvious to us was that that was just a piece of it. There was then the integrated firm, like the Merrill Lynch or Bache, which also traded in the over-the-counter market for over-the-counter market stocks. That was a wholly different kind of situation because they were not only making a market in the company, in a given company, for institutional investors or for other market makers sometimes, but also to service their own retail force and their own institutional sales. So they were an integrated firm. For example, a specialist doesn't have a retail client base. A pure market maker did not have like Troster Singer did not have a client base, but Merrill Lynch did. Well, what did they do? Were they operating in any different way? How did they finance themselves? How much capital did they need? We would do this not just day after day, week after week, month after month. We would have perhaps as many as 100, ended up with perhaps as many as 100 highly intensive interviews. We would then write them up, not just the interview, but we would try to focus on what we saw as the strategic issues which were raised. And we would tell the firm, look, just tell us what you do. We're not looking for it to put any, in fact, as far as I know, nobody ever was enjoined or there was never any criminal activity. We were just trying to increase our base of knowledge.
You did have to use the subpoena every now and then.
Yes. Yeah. And often to get records because some of the records were confidential. That we were asking the firm for the names of their clients, their customers, and who they were dealing with. We even on occasion went to banks. Well, how do you finance these firms and why do you finance them? So we understood how the securities market functioned. And while that was going on, my colleagues were doing the same thing. What does an odd lot dealer do on the stock exchange? What does a floor trader do? What does a retail firm do? What does a specialist do? So you could imagine this enormous tens and tens of thousands of pages of information that was being synthesized.
Did you ever get together, say, with David Silver, who's looking at New York Stock Exchange, and sort of compare notes?
Well, it was constant. Yeah, we were constantly talking to each other because the special study was a very tight group. We were all young lawyers, and we were doing all this work. We did not have a priori a view as to, oh, this is where we're going to come out. What we wanted to do was just get the information. And, you know, jumping way ahead, the knowledge base was so substantial, that is the reason why you see so many of the special study people then become partners of law firms, heads of stock exchanges, heads of the New York Stock Exchange. Fred Moss became the president of Boston, I think, and Philadelphia. Ralph Saul became the head of the American Stock Exchange. Bob Birnbaum became the head of the New York Stock Exchange. Dave Silver became the head of the Investment Company Institute. Others became senior partners in major law firms. I stayed on. I did not leave right after the special study. But that was the whole point, and then we began to develop what the public policy issues were.
As part of the special study.
As part of the special study.
The analysis.
What were troublesome, almost fraudulent activities, what were not fraudulent but raised questions of public policy, what were issues of fairness, what were issues of structure. And recommendations were made as to whether regulation or legislation might be needed. Those, of course, after the study was concluded, went up to the commission, they agreed or disagreed, and then went over to Congress.
And when you're writing this, I mean, the ultimate consumer is Congress. They've asked for the study.
Right.
So was there some sense that, you know, we want to be aware of what some of the legislative fixes might be? I mean, was there the idea that you're writing it for that audience?
I don't think so. I don't think so. Oh, not in terms of we know legislation would be needed, but there was no politics in the sense, well, what will the Republican or Democrat say about this? It was simply, this can be done by regulation by the Commission's existing power. This might need legislation. Keep in mind, this is before automation. There were major sections on automation which began to creep into the special study when we realized that a lot of this could be automated, and there were major recommendations on automation.
The market, the 62 market break came
right in the middle.
Yeah. What was the effect?
There was a special part of the study which did a case study of the market break. And again, keep in mind that there were at least a half a dozen of us who had established very good, very deep ties with the street. And we immediately went to them and said, what's going on? What's happened? What do you think? And because we had a very substantial background, the language got shortcutted in the sense that, well, this and this happened, and so-and-so went short, and this caused the banks to pull their lines of credit, and we had to draw a margin here. And we knew exactly what was happening, so that it wasn't as if we had to start de novo. What is this thing called the market?
Right.
We were deeply into it. So we did that, we did that too.
It must have been an interesting experience for you to develop these relationships with people on the street, and vice versa.
Yeah. Yes, I think it was interesting. We did develop very there were close relationships in this fact. I think there was a mutual trust. If you look, if you talk to people on the street at that time, we gave them our word that we were trying to find out what the facts were, but they knew that we were representing what we considered to be the public interest, that we might recommend things which were highly adversarial to them. But we were not out to get them at all. This was not a fraud investigation such as you will see on insider trading.
Right.
And therefore, the relationships were very good. But they were respectful and distant. When you put someone under oath, there is an adversarial nature to it. And keep in mind that all of us were lawyers. So we tended to be somewhat adversarial to begin with, and we were from the SEC. So there was distance in that sense.
What was the high point for you of that experience going through the special study?
Well, the whole thing for all of us, I think, was a high virtually every day. We couldn't wait to get to work, because it would be yet a new firm we were going to visit. We were going to learn not just for ourselves, but we're going to memorialize in a document the way the securities market worked. And the commission, if you think about it, never had done that before. The commission had focused on accounting rules, disclosure, inside information, immediate dissemination of information. It looked, therefore, at corporate governance. It looked at events or conditions which would enable the public to feel comfortable that the corporation was disclosing to it, the consumer, all relevant information in a timely basis, and that corporate governance would not permit insider trading. Nothing about how the markets worked. They never looked at that. The commission never looked at how markets worked. And that's the reason for the study. And it became clear to us that that was a big omission. How markets work, actually work. To this day, the general public doesn't know how markets work.
And the market likes it that way.
Well, it's they don't know how markets work. The commission knows how markets work because of the special study. They still do not know how the derivatives markets work because they have never had a special study on that huge complex area. And that is to their enormous disadvantage. Nor does the Fed know. And the only way to find it out, without getting too far advanced, is to have dedicated, reasonably intelligent people sit down and methodically, month after month, say, tell me why you did this and what you're doing and how you make a living and how much it costs and who developed that technique and what are you doing?
But there probably was a political window that made this possible, that allowed Congress to say, SEC, we want you to choose a group of people and just let them do this.
Probably. Could have happened at any other time, possibly. But there was, in fact, a window. Also, you had between Manny Cohen and Bill Carey, you had a an Irv Pollack. You had three very strong public policy-oriented leaders. In addition, it was quite fortuitous that Dave Silver found not just policy issues, but fraud on a stock exchange. That, of course, was a incendiary matter. My area, the hot issues, had nothing to do with fraud. It had to do with greed. That also made it somewhat incendiary when people doubled their investments overnight. So the two combined opened up that political window. It also made it very difficult for those who did not like the idea to close the window.
Who were the people who didn't like the idea?
I don't know. I'm making a theoretical statement. But, you know, as the special study reached its conclusions, the commission became much more involved and much more nervous about what was being recommended. Mm-hmm. And there were political, not political Republican Democrat, but there were Wall Street was saying, they're going to recommend what? And they would go to their buddies on the commission. Keep in mind that that Freedom of Information Act didn't exist then. So that would happen. It also meant that the staff of the special study realized that. Milt Cohen, for the most part, ignored it. We were very fortunate that Kerry had as his executive assistant Art Fleischer.
Why?
And, you know, Art, then, who subsequently went to managing partner Fried Frank, very intelligent, very ethical, very honest, politically aware of what Kerry could do with a split commission. And there were sessions, I'm sure, I know, where Art would give his views on a particular recommendation, Milt would give his views, and we essentially follow what Milt said. This is not to say that Art was opposed to them. He just wanted the commission, the staff, to realize that some of these things were not likely to be unanimously approved by the commission. And indeed, they weren't. And he would tell us where there were differences of opinion.
And my understanding,
amongst the commissioners.
My understanding is that Congress didn't want the report from the staff. Congress wanted the report from the commission. Is that right?
Well, they wanted it from the commission, but they wanted it to be, they wanted to have the commission's views on it, but they did not want the commission having the power to change those views before they got it. And so that's what the compromise was. You got the commission's views, which Congress is entitled to, but the commission's views on what this independent study was. And they could not change the recommendations of the special study, and nor did they. And that's to Milt Cohen's credit.
Yeah, there wasn't any self-censorship, so to speak, of doing things because you know that this is what the commission...
No, because the commission was split on most of the issues. And the reason they were split was in part because these were very complicated policy issues, and reasonable people could differ. And did differ.
And one would wonder how much the commissioners actually knew about all this stuff.
They knew very little. They knew very little.
Yeah.
In a sense, the study was modest. It didn't say, you must do this. But it was strong. It would lay out both sides of most arguments, too, also. So you... probably have seen the study. I have it somewhere over there, a couple volumes.
Yeah, it's a big document.
Yeah.
Well, moving on from that,
right.
You talked about how a lot of the people, you know, learned so much in this process, and
right.
They took that knowledge and went somewhere else.
Right.
You went into something called the Office of Policy Research.
Right.
Is that right? Now, was that office itself a product of the special study?
Yes.
Tell me about the idea.
Well, the idea was, here goes the study, it's done. And hundreds of recommendations. Well, which ones are you going to look at first? And I became the chief counsel of the Office of Policy Research under Walter Werner, who was the director, lawyer, superb lawyer. People began to leave the commission, leave the special study, and take, as you know, jobs elsewhere. But I like policy research, and I like making and thinking about policy, and as a practical matter, although I had been offered a number of jobs in Wall Street, and my wife and I were quite happy to live in Washington, I did not want to move to New York. I thought that there were a number of issues which should be looked into and resolved and focused on. And what else was I going to do? at the commission. I'm not going to go back to reading registration statements. I wasn't all that interested in enforcement, although I did hire for the special study Stan Sporkin. I hired him for the study, who subsequently, as you know, became the director of enforcement and then became the general counsel of the CIA, and then, of course, became a federal judge and is still a very close personal friend. I might mention that all of us who worked on the special study, almost without exception, see each other constantly socially. We see each other now a couple times a year at some event or at some social gathering, and we are all very close. In any event, I decided to stay on, and Mike Eisenberg also stayed on for a while, and they formed this Office of Policy Research essentially to pick those things in the special study to implement.
So the Office of Policy Research was looking more to implement things than continue doing research.
Yes, except in one area. And it was the one area which linked the over-the-counter market and the New York Stock Exchange. And that was the third market under Frank Whedon and M.A. Shapiro. In addition, the New York Stock Exchange was going through its, I don't know if it's once every 10 years or how often it was, it's raising its commission rates through its so-called I&E reports. That's the income and expense reports, which went to the commission, which had never been looked at even on an informal basis.
These are the exchange's income and expense reports.
No, the member firms' income and expense reports to justify the commission. And that landed in the Office of Policy Research. And what became obvious is, one, no one had ever looked at this stuff before, and second, to the extent we began to look at it, it was clear that the exchange, which forwarded these reports to us, was making the case that their profits were not excessive. And we were supposed to look at this massive amount of data to see whether their profits were excessive. From the commission business. That is, whether the firms could not charge more than X. Because to charge more than X, to have a yet a higher rate, would mean that their profits were excessive.
Right.
And the exchange said, under the Exchange Act, you have to approve this, and that approval is your stamp of approval. Well, it occurred to me that, A, for the first time, we were going to look at this stuff rather than simply say, okay, but that it was the maximum rate which we were looking at. That is, you couldn't have more than this rate that you are proposing, otherwise it will be excessive. Not that this is the minimum rate that you should have in order to stay viable. Later, that became an extremely crucial legal issue, as I'll describe to you, because the New York Stock Exchange argued the commission gave us the seal of approval. Therefore, they have approved our antitrust exemption, because they, as a government agency, have said we need that minimum amount to stay viable and to maintain our regulatory posture. Mm-hmm. It was clear to me when I began to look at that data that we were not asked that, that we were being asked to approve it as a maximum. It also became clear on looking at the data, which we already knew, that firms had commissions, charged commissions, which were minimum fixed antitrust, and then gave away huge amounts of their commissions. That then raised the question as to what, in fact, this commission really was. At the same time, Frank Whedon and Don Whedon would come in, as would M.A. Shapiro, and say, look, we're making this market. We can sell to institutions and to New York Stock Exchange members at a lower price than these institutions are paying. Because we are over-the-counter market makers. And Gene, you know how the over-the-counter market works. There's a bid and ask, and we take a little markup, and that's it. Or we get a profit between the bid and ask. I said, well, of course, it's a rhetorical question. Do you do much business with stock exchange members? He said, no, of course, we do zero with them because they're not allowed to deal with us. We only deal with institutions. And, of course, we do that. And that led to this enormous study of Rule 394, which is what should be the rules with respect to the stock exchange's members being able to deal with third market makers.
Right.
That, in turn, got very close to the subject of automation. What is a market? How to, you know, who are buyers and sellers? So that this, the Office of Policy Research found itself heavily involved in what the commission should be and what the role of the third market should be and the role of the regional stock exchanges, which was covered by the special study. And here you had a group of us in the special study, in the Office of Policy Research, who knew what went on regional stock exchanges, which was a part of the special study. Second, what went on in the New York Stock Exchange. Third, what went on in the third market. And fourth, what went on in the over-the-counter market. And fifth, how the over-the-counter market in general worked. At the same time that's happening, the New York Stock Exchange wants an approval of its latest set of commissions.
Right.
As a maximum. And I remember one of my first discussions with the New York Stock Exchange members saying, you're talking about maximum, aren't you? And they said, no, minimums. I said, minimums. What does minimum have to do with how much profit you're making? And they said, well, we can't be lower than this, otherwise we'll go out of business or can't supervise. And then, of course, as you can imagine, this rhetorical question then opens up the floodgates on a whole range of issues, which are volume discounts, institutional membership, and the propriety of fixity of commissions, all of which is in the special study. I mean, all of which is raised in the special study and is being examined by the Office of Policy Research.
Right. You couldn't separate any of these issues. They're all bound up.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. And for the first time, we're very fortunate because we have people who know all of the different parts, how each part works.
Now, about this time, isn't Morris Shapiro filing his lawsuit?
Yes.
And getting things
moving
in one direction?
Well, seven things are happening. I happen to write them down,
right.
And I'd be glad to share them with you. I then, around that time,
it's around 65?
Yeah, 65, 66. Irv Pollack has now become the director of market regulation. And I am asked to become the associate director for market regulation under Irv. Dan Sporkin is the director of enforcement. And Irv and Manny Cohen, who's now chairman, say, look, no longer is this a matter for research, that is, the Office of Policy Research. We have got to look at how we're going to respond to this package of issues, because the New York Stock Exchange has these I&E reports in front of us, and they want to have a commission increase. Therefore, Gene, how about you moving over to actually regulate, come up with rules?
So your job title followed the issues.
Right.
Study to rules.
Study, research, execute. Aaron, I draft up this 394 report, but with extensive discussions with, having already had over the previous years extensive discussions with Morris Shapiro and Don Whedon and the New York Stock Exchange. And at that time, there is this, having been through the special study, for want of a better term, there is this not subliminal, but undercurrent that if you want to get something done of substantial magnitude, the commission itself, the five members, are not the vehicle to get it done. That is, they have become politicized.
They become a captive agency?
It's not so much captive. It's more they're there because they agree to begin with. They're not taking orders. They just feel that markets should work or people should work in a certain way. Whatever our prejudices and biases were, it was clear the staff felt that the commission might have to, at the end, approve things, but it should be perfunctory. That's a terrible thing to say. But that is, in fact, what the staff felt, for better or for worse. It's not something I'm particularly happy about. And you ultimately, you have to go through the commission. But the commission should at least get the benefit of not only what the staff thinks, but they should make decisions based upon what the facts are. So, what we did is the following in corporate reg. In market regulation. We knew, because of our previous incarnation at the Special Study and the Office of Policy Research, that members of the New York Stock Exchange would charge, say, $100,000 commission, fixed minimum, and would give away almost $80,000 of it at the direction of the client, the customer. They would say, keep $20,000 and take $80,000 of it and give it to firm A, B, C, D, who are selling our mutual fund. Or give it to firm D, E, F, who give us research. So the firm who did the execution, we keep $20,000, even though they had to charge $100,000. Second, the stock exchange, we knew, since the Buttonwood Agreement, is not where executions of orders take place. The stock exchange is where orders are recorded, that the transactions occur in the office of the firm, where particularly large ones, where they would find a buyer, would walk in, and they would find a seller by picking up the phone. When the two agreed to a price, they then take the order to the stock exchange where it was recorded. We also knew that. The Buttonwood Agreement, which formed the New York Stock Exchange, simply established that there are people who are members and there are people who are non-members. All members charge each other X. All non-members have to pay 10 times X. It was all a stock exchange is, therefore, is a facility to separate members and non-members, to have one rate for members and another rate for non-members. And a non-member is all customers. And a member is anybody who isn't a customer who's an investment banker. Well, that's interesting. And the stock exchange had this pretense that it's where orders get done. Well, some orders get done there, yes. But the big stuff gets done in the offices of the firms. And then they're brought to the stock exchange. And then, as I said, these $100,000 commissions. So we asked, he said, by the way, you're giving away all this money. Why don't you give a volume discount? And the firm said, oh, we can't give a volume discount. I said, well, you're giving a volume discount of 80% anyway. And they said, but we're dividing it amongst members. But they weren't, because it turns out that they would often bring it to a regional stock exchange, what I call the cross, C-R-O-S-S. They would do the order in New York, and Fidelity Fund would be selling, and IDS would be the buyer. They would agree on a price of 30 and an eighth. They would then bring it and record it on the Pacific Coast Stock Exchange. Why? Not New York. Why? Because the New York Stock Exchange said, rules say you can divide your commissions if you're members of the New York Stock Exchange only amongst our members. The Pacific Coast Stock Exchange said you can divide your commissions only among our members. And by the way, any one of the 8,000 NASD members are members. So you now could divide it to this little firm in Iowa who's not a member of the New York Stock Exchange. So you have Goldman Sachs or Solomon Brothers doing an order on the Pacific Coast Stock Exchange and giving it to a non-New York Stock Exchange member, 80% of the commission. So the money wasn't even kept by New York Stock Exchange members. It was given to 8,000 NASD members. We knew that, too. And then there were some firms who said, I'm not going to even join the New York Stock Exchange. I'll do these crosses myself and do them on Cincinnati. And orders would get done on Cincinnati, because Cincinnati had rules which permitted you to give it to virtually anybody in the world, part of the commission. Well, we knew all of this. But what was not known is that every firm in Wall Street did not know what every other firm was doing. A firm knew what it was doing, how it was dividing up commissions, but it did not know what other firms were doing on other stock exchanges and for what purpose. So the money was given for compensation having nothing to do with the securities industry. Money was being given, as I said, for selling mutual funds or for research. Money was given to some brokerage firm because a child of the firm doing the order went to work for that firm. They just gave him the money, part of the commission. And other firms did not know what their competitors were doing. So I thought that it would be nice to have this publicly disseminated so that all firms would know what everybody is doing. Well, you can imagine. So that was the first thing we did. We're going to have public hearings. And in the public hearings, we are going to explore how every firm, how dozens of firms, what their practices are, and how they divide up the commissions. Well, that caused enormous economic pressure, because now the firm realized, hey, I can do what they're doing. the New York Stock Exchange got rather distressed because they realized now what Pacific Coast and the Midwest Stock Exchange was doing. They have a rather small membership on New York. These others had memberships in up to 8,000, all NASD members. So they realize, oh, my heavens, Fidelity Fund won't give me the business because I can't reward this firm in Ohio because they're not a member of New York. But therefore, they'll bring the business to the Pacific Coast Stock Exchange because they have a wider distribution network and the money isn't going to New York, the transaction. And if it doesn't go to New York, that means the specialist doesn't get see the order. So the specialists get very upset. You're siphoning business away to the regionals. So at virtually every level, this increased enormously the economic pressure. At the same time that that happened, New York, therefore, wanted to say to its members, you can't bring your order to Pacific or to Midwest. In walks the president of the Pacific Coast Stock Exchange to the commission and says, why are you trying to hurt California? Why are you trying to, in walks the president of Chicago, why are you trying to hurt Chicago? And we say, we're not trying to hurt, it's New York is doing it. They then say, we're not going to let those guys do this. So we then create antagonism between these stock exchanges. And lo and behold, who is the staff in favor of? The staff is on the side of supporting the smaller regional stock exchanges who have enormous support in Congress and everywhere else, mm-hmm. against the big bully New York Stock Exchange. So that you have the New York Stock Exchange now fighting with the regionals. That was not an accident. It was to create a sense that the regionals have their right to do what they want to do. So that was the second element.
And those were the hearings that you held around 65 or so,
yeah.
on Rule 394.
Correct. Okay. 394, and these were, this is in 60, going through 67 now. Okay. There was a third event, the third market. Then testifies that they're willing to give the price at a much lower rate. And that has an interesting twist. If you're a mutual fund or an insurance company, you have beneficiaries or you have stockholders, and somebody is testifying for the first time that you can give you a better price, why are you going to the New York Stock Exchange member at all? Why aren't you going to the third market? And, of course, the reason you go to the stock exchange, who's bearing that cost? The cost is being borne by the holder of the mutual fund. The reason you're going is because they will generate $80,000 of commissions that you can give to help the management company. And if you go with the third market, it's a net principal trade. There's nothing to give away. It all goes to whatever the stockholders have to pay the expense. You don't have any extra, quote, soft money to give away for selling mutual funds, which has nothing to do with the value of the portfolio. So you're all of a sudden caught between what's in the best interest of the management company of the mutual fund or the insurance company, and what's in the best interest of your beneficiaries. You don't want to be in that position when it's public, because you know that within a week you're going to get sued for defrauding your stockholders and not lowering the total cost to them. The mutual fund then answers, but they give us research sometimes. And we said, but wait a minute, you're already charging research. For research. Well, this is extra research. Well, why don't you pay for it out of your management fee? Raise the management fee. Just disclose it. And the thing begins to snowball. So the existence of the third market begins to put pressure. While that's happening, you get a fourth development. The Justice Department then we open up discussions with the Justice Department, with Lionel Kestenbaum, with Justice. We say, Lionel, we've got an antitrust problem here. It's one thing to have a fixed minimum. You know, the argues back and forth whether there was a question whether we do approve the minimumness or the maximumness. We at the Commission think we don't approve the minimumness. But even if we do, one thing that will destroy an antitrust exemption, if you have one, on the grounds that you can't get anything less, is if you take the amount and give it away through a rebate. They're rebating their commissions. And they're rebating it to strangers who have nothing to do with the New York Stock Exchange or even members of the New York Stock Exchange, but it certainly have nothing to do with the transaction. And therefore, they have whatever antitrust potential exemption they have, they've lost it. And there are now we've shown that we're giving as much as 90% of their fixed commission away. And the first piece of testimony with the New York Stock Exchange, I remember asking Bishop, do you have a fixed commission? He said, yes. I said, do you give it away? He said, yes. I said, so what's fixed about it? You're rebating it. He said, competitive pressure, it's very hard for him to defend it. It's fixity, because that's what you have to defend if you're trying to get an antitrust exemption.
So they were creating the illusion of fixity in order to
yeah, but they couldn't create it for more than 2 seconds because all the firms would testify that they weren't keeping it. The firms were then complaining to New York that this has proliferated so wide through all the regional stock exchanges that they're being left with virtually nothing. So the economic the disclosure was beginning to hurt them. The third market was hurting them. The mutual funds and the insurance companies were afraid of lawsuits, and then come the lawsuits. That was the fifth piece.
And this was Morris Shapiro driving this?
Morris drove one, that they weren't dealing with him, and the Pomerantz law firm also began to sue all the mutual funds. And I must tell you that one of the members of the Pomerantz law firm was my colleague in the over-the-counter market, Dick Meyer. And he went to the law firm. So that we then, at the commission, called in mutual funds under oath. And there's a very interesting transcript of my examining Johnson at Fidelity. And I said to him, why don't you deal in the third market? Told him. Anyway, he realizes a record is being made that he's being told about this. And then he was asked, did you direct give-ups from Goldman Sachs to go to XYZ? He said, yes. And did you do often transactions on another stock exchange and direct give-ups to people who weren't even members of the New York Stock Exchange? He said, yes. So the next question was, do you know that the give-ups can go to any member of the New York Stock Exchange, any NASD member? He said, yes. And, of course, the next question was, why don't you become a member of the Pacific Coast Stock Exchange and keep the commissions for your stockholders? You're allowed to become an NASD member. That raises the question of institutional membership. And therefore, direct the commissions back to yourself being your stockholders. And all of a sudden, he now has a record in front of him, which is the subject matter of the lawsuit. And he now knows that he officially can go to the Pacific. And Pacific basically says, yeah, you can become a member. That subsequently went to court, and there is a footnote in Judge Wazanski's opinion that said it is true that Gene Rotberg did point this out, that he could do this if he wanted to, so he had advance notice of it. But Rotberg was only a subordinate employee at the SEC, had no reason to follow that suggestion or advice. Well, Wazanski subsequently got reversed. because he had been told by an official of a government agency, you can do it. But I didn't have to tell him. He knew it. So you now had a situation where the mutual funds were being put on notice and were being sued privately for taking these commissions and using it for purposes not for the benefit of their stockholders. You had pressure amongst the firms themselves to copy each other's techniques and lower the commissions even more, or keep the commissions to even lower amount. You had the regionals who were thinking of all kinds of new ways now to divide up the commissions to people who weren't even members of the NASD. You had the third market going public with what they were doing. You had, therefore, and all of this was being publicly disseminated.
How was it being publicly disseminated?
Hearings. Okay. Public hearings in the newspapers.
This is not the 68 hearing.
Yeah.
Okay, this is the summer of 68.
These are all going through.
Yeah.
First it was private, then it was public.
Gotcha.
We then decided we needed one more piece to this to increase essentially the economic pressure, because we all believed in free enterprise and competition. What it was, it came from what you might consider an unlikely source, Merrill Lynch. And I remember a conversation with Don Regan, and Don would say, Gene, if we don't have fixed commissions, we're going to put all these other firms out of business, because we're so big, we have so many branches, we have so much retail business, we'll just lower the commissions and we'll get even more business. So, but we can't, we're not allowed to under the New York Stock Exchange rules. So here you have the head of the biggest firm in terms of retail withdrawing support for the fixity of commissions, because he thought he could put everybody else out of business,
right,
who had retail customers. If that wasn't enough, we had Gus Levy of Goldman Sachs also coming to this commission and saying to the staff, you know, I'm giving away too much of my commissions. If I can only negotiate and not have to give anything away, I'll be better off. And we're more efficient than other firms. We'll be able to do these crosses in our office. I don't want to be pushed to being doing them on Midwest or Pacific Coast. I'd like to be able just to offer them what I can. So you had Goldman Sachs also breaking away from the New York Stock Exchange. Then the third firm was IDS, Investor Diversified Services. They came, and Bob Leffler came to us and said, Gene, we think we're going to join a stock exchange. We might as well get these commissions for the benefit of our stockholders. Now, why could IDS do it and not Fidelity or Putnam? The reason is IDS was a it had its own sales force. It didn't use other brokers to sell the mutual funds.
No.
So it could afford, since it never had to pay for selling funds, it could just get a lower commission. It would advertise its lower commission. It would become a member of a stock exchange. It didn't have to pay the outside firm. It had its own internal sales force. That put enormous pressure on the other funds from a legal point of view of doing the same. What were they going to argue? No, we need somebody else to make our fund bigger and get a higher management fee, because the management fee, as you know, is based upon not performance, but is based upon the size of the fund. So you would pay commissions to people who would sell the funds.
Is the idea here that IDS could be in the New York Exchange where the others couldn't?
The IDS could join the regionals.
The regionals.
New York said you can't join our firm. Under the Buttonwood Agreement, you're called a non-customer. You're called a customer. He says, fine, I'll join a regional. We wouldn't, and the commission would therefore would get a request from the regional to change their rules. We said, fine, you can change your rules. All that is going on. All these things are going on at the same time. And obviously justice then gets involved in bringing a big lawsuit. And I think there were amicus at first in the Thill case. So from every way, the pressure simply became too much. There were these six or seven things going on simultaneously. The New York Stock Exchange found itself in an intolerable position. They tried to negotiate. They tried to not negotiate, but they tried to first come up with a volume discount. That didn't work.
Wasn't that sort of a half measure? Or
yeah,
something like that?
Exactly. That would be enough, but that wasn't enough because you could still give away part of the volume discount. The purpose of the public hearings was to bring all of this together in 67, 68. And I was given the responsibility for conducting these hearings. And they were very gentlemanly. They were very nice hearings. They were not adversarial. We would just simply go through, what do you do? Same as I had done 5 or 6 years before. And so you give these commissions away. Do you know the firm? No. How often do you do it? Every month. Why did you bring this order to this exchange? Because the customer told me to. Why didn't you go to the third market? Because the New York Stock Exchange doesn't let me. Well, they just were just building an enormous case for both private lawsuits, antitrust lawsuits, and fiduciary lawsuits against their institutional investor for their failure to take advantage of what could be done. Then the regionals would come in, and they would basically say, well, yeah, we're not hurting the market at all. Then the New York Stock Exchange made, I think, a tactical error. They brought in, I guess it was Samuelson, to argue in the public hearings. He said that if they went to negotiate commission rates, it would be the end of the stock exchanges because the rates would go so far down, there would be what he called destructive price competition. And it would be destructive price competition. Because some firms would put other firms out of business, and the rate which they would charge wouldn't be sufficient for them to maintain their supervisory responsibilities under the Securities Act. And he testified on and on about this. What he apparently did not know was that New York Stock Exchange members do not have to charge, nor did they ever charge, a fixed commission on their over-the-counter stocks, 8,000. So I asked him, what do you think would happen if there were no fixed commission with respect to the purchase of Bank of America, which is in the over-the-counter market? He says, oh, the same thing would happen. The market couldn't exist, the firms would go out of business. And then I went through two or three other stocks which were over-the-counter. I said, do you know that there is no fixed commission in the over-the-counter? He didn't know. He thought that the fixity applied across the board. Of course, it didn't. In fact, there was no commission at all if they were dealing as principal. So
did that get some headlines?
Yeah, I think all that stuff got publicized. Publicized in the... Because Eileen Shanahan of the New York Times and Carol Loomis at Fortune were covering this stuff. Just the combination of these things that I've described and the fact we had some big member firms taking the same position. When the commission was finally handed and saw all this stuff, and the New York Stock Exchange saw it, there was no issue left. It was just a matter of time before the whole thing would be voluntarily pulled out. The antitrust suits were going on, triple damages against all New York Stock Exchange members for violations of the Sherman Act. I mean, there was big money involved. And that essentially then rippled across into England. It became Big Bang, and the whole thing then dissolved.
It took a while, though.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But you're saying it was inevitable that we'd lose Rule 394, that commission rates would become unfixed.
Right. And that's it was inevitable. I then, keep in mind that what was then happening was that I was conducting these hearings in the fall of 68. The election was in November. Nixon wrote an open letter to Wall Street, and I think Chuck Colson wrote it. And he wrote he was going to get rid of, if he were elected, all these young liberal Kennedy-type lawyers who were giving Wall Street such a hard time. And I, thought this was targeted at me and my colleagues, my buddies at the commission who were conducting these hearings.
And probably was.
And I well, probably was. But Wall Street had already given up. Their own economic pressures meant it, let alone the fear of the antitrust and the institutions were getting sued. There were just too many pressures from all directions. They would get rid of these. Well, Nixon won the election in November. Mm-hmm. I was at the World Bank by December. Mm-hmm. No one fired me. But I knew that I had no future there left. I knew that I could do. I hopefully with others, Irv Pollack in particular, and Manny, I probably put things into play which were irreversible, and indeed they were.
You may have expended your capital.
So. Oh, I'm afraid so. And I think the story goes that a couple of the firms had called who. Bob McNamara, who had just become president of the World Bank, and said, get rid of this, take this guy. But I don't think that's what happened. Bob happened to call McNamara had been the president of Ford Motor Company. His investment banker was First Boston. He called the president of First Boston and said, do you know anybody who might... called Emil Patberg, who might be useful to be the vice president and treasurer of the World Bank. He said, I know one guy who I would recommend, and within a matter of days, I was at the bank.
It seems like an interesting leap, though, because you'd never been treasurer of anything.
Nothing.
How Wall Street works.
Well, you know, if you look at some of the articles at the time, they said that I was hired because I was an adversarial, difficult, not different, an adversarial, a trial lawyer opposed to Wall Street.
And that's what they needed at the World Bank?
And the World Bank, and McNamara wanted someone who was not beholden to Wall Street, mm-hmm. and who was not going to be overwhelmed by the reputation of Wall Street was. Mm-hmm. And I had very, very good personal contacts with all these people, even the people who are adversarial with. It was mutually respectful. I wasn't trying to put anybody away. I was just trying to make some policy changes that it was inevitable from what they had done to themselves. Beyond that, just as a personal matter, I had been at that time. I had been offered jobs, and I was going to go to either Salomon Brothers with John Gutfreund. And John said, here's the deal. You come here, take my place, and I will go to the World Bank and take that job. Or I was going to go with Leon Levy at Oppenheimer. And I was toying with those three, with that plus the World Bank offer, and I decided I still wanted to be a public service. And so, because I was still then and still am much more interested in public service, and to me the World Bank was the ultimate public service. Only this time Wall Street was going to be my underwriters, but I was going to get the money from their clients and give it to the poor. And to the poor, that's the perfect Robin Hood job.
Still a little Kennedy liberalism.
Exactly, and I wasn't self-conscious about that at all. So within a matter of weeks, I would be going seeing these same firms and saying, let's negotiate now on the interest rate. So we knew each other very well. So I became very, I had always been very close to Don Regan and John Gutfreund and Gus Levy at Goldman Sachs and all the firms. So I knew them all. And it didn't hurt the bank at all. And I went to the bank for 20 years. And then I went to Merrill for two, to risk management, at the very end of my public career. If you want to go back now on the special study, you may have some questions.
Well, I do have a question, not that far back, but I'd like you to set the scene for me a little bit in those hearings.
Yes.
I understand the very first day you talked to, what was it, the vice president?
Bishop. Bob Bishop.
There was a lot of press coverage because it's the first day. What was it like in there? Did you feel like you were well prepared? Did you have support?
Hopefully I'm a good lawyer, but you never ask a question where you don't know the answer.
Right.
I don't remember asking a single question that I didn't know what he was going to answer. But we had a lot of fun there. I had a big sign I had put up. It just said, "Give up." And the "give up" was a pun, obviously.
Two meanings there.
Yeah, it was a pun. Poor Bob, he had to defend the indefensible. He finally ended up, I think, saying, "Look, the money stays in the securities industry." I said, "But it doesn't stay with New York Stock Exchange members." He said, "No, but it's to all the securities members." I said, "But anybody could become a securities member. It could be like joining the Diners Club. It could become an NASD member." He said, "Yes." I said, "Can I become an NASD member?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Can a mutual fund become an NASD member?" "Yes." So I said, "So who can't become one?" And he just couldn't. It was indefensible. And he had to, poor Bob, had to be very careful because he's a staff member of the New York Stock Exchange. They were themselves by that time split. You had Goldman and Merrill not wanting to have nothing to do with it. You had their lawyers telling them that you're subject to potential triple damages for violations of the Sherman Act. And finally, I remember asking, "Would you like to do away with all the regional stock exchanges?" And here you have very outstanding men who are the heads of all these stock exchanges. He said, "It would be better if they weren't there." So you had him having to be constantly defend an indefensible position, which had started in the end of the 18th century, 1700s, when they formed the original stock exchange. It was the same set of rules, that you must charge a fixed minimum to every outsider. That was the Buttonwood Agreement. And here he has to defend it, and the world has changed. And everybody knows now how it's changed. So in answer to your question, I looked upon this as a not very different than the interviews that I had conducted during the special study.
Except there you didn't know the answers.
There I didn't know the answers. There it was fact gathering. And it wasn't until very far, after many, many times, that you know the answers. The answers were known here because these pieces that you referred to earlier, the regionals, the third market, the stock exchange, the integrated firm, the over-the-counter market, the difference between what Merrill does and Goldman Sachs, the institutional pressures, the lawsuits, that was all within the knowledge of the staff at the commission. Probably to a greater extent than any one firm knew. And so we would know how the third world market finances itself more than how Merrill didn't know how the third market did it. And often the regionals didn't open up very easily what their rules were to every member, to members of other stock exchanges, so that we knew more. When you're in a position where you have how the system works, you have somewhat of an advantage.
So in a sense, this is a classic case of shedding light on on things.
Exactly.
And letting them sort themselves out in the light of day.
Exactly. And keep in mind, since then, we've seen many federal commissions, you know, whether it was Iraq or 9/11 or thalidomide. But on this one, the reason this was quite so remarkable with the commission and the subsequent hearings is you didn't have any differences of opinion or different constituencies amongst the commission members. The commission members here were the staff of the SEC. We didn't have, we were in fact-finding until the last 2 years. And I personally believe that the commission itself as an entity has suffered because of its inability or unwillingness to have these kinds of studies on issues which are, to me, very, very important, like derivatives, off-balance sheet transactions, which really overwhelm what we knew at the special study. In other words, if you ask any of us who are on the special study, could you describe the market today? Any of us who have any degree of sensitivity or modesty will say, absolutely not. We have no idea what's going on. We lost it 10 or 15, 20 years ago. And as of 2007, highly doubtful whether anybody in government knows how the market works, knows the importance of various kinds of transactions. Unknown. Is it unknowable? No. And I argued four times on the Hill, in both Senate hearings and House hearings, and at the commission itself, for a massive study on the way the security markets now operate.
When?
In the last 8 years. And that's been ignored.
What kind of opportunities were these that you were in?
Oh, whenever there was a scandal, they would call me down to the Hill to testify. And at one point, the last one, whether it was long-term capital or the Salomon Brothers debacle or the Barings or Daiwa Security, Orange County, Sumitomo, whenever there was a derivative issue, they would call me down. I would talk about the need for a special study. And then the last time they called me, I wouldn't go. I said, here are my previous transcripts. I'm going to say the same thing.
Yeah.
And then I went to the commission itself, and I gave a long speech there about 3 years ago on this subject, on not what we're talking about, on how the securities markets have changed, and I don't know how they've changed. And I think it's time for the commission to find, and the Fed to find out, and this pretense that they know is nonsense. They don't know. And
how was that received at the SEC?
Well, the staff loved it, but nothing ever happened. And I think there should be a massive study, an independent study on how the securities markets function. And I think it frankly should be conducted not by economists, but by lawyers who can get the facts out. Later on, there'll be plenty of time to see what you want to do about it. Maybe you can't do anything, but you find out what happens, who does what, and how do they do it, why do they do it, how do you finance it, what are the risks, what is the leverage. The markets today are enormously leveraged.
Well, what's standing in the way, do you think?
Probably partisan politics, you know, probably the Fed. The Fed is very nervous, given our deficit, about any tinkering or even examination of what frankly goes on in the futures markets, because it supports the bond market. And I know that they have previously said that we think there are abuses, but they ought to be taken care of. They can be taken care of. They don't want to mess with it.
Yeah.
And I can understand where they're coming from. And they may be right.
If it ain't broke, right?
They say it's not broke until the next scandal. And there always is a next scandal. The latest one was Enron. Enron had nothing to do with corporate accounting and corporate malfeasance. That was the vehicle where it exploded. What was going on was what the firm was doing, which was a series of derivatives. of a virtual reality issue. And they did it through various firms. It just happened to be in the securities industry, in the oil and gas industry, which is a product like a stock. Oil and gas is simply like a security. It's called a commodity. Long-term capital was in the bond markets. But there will be another one. And the theory is that the banks know how to protect themselves. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. I do know that the SEC doesn't understand it.
Yeah. Well, and I think there are those who would admit that.
Yeah.
Certainly on staff.
Yeah. Yeah, and they should find out, and it's so that when you get another crisis, you at least know where to look and who to call on the phone, who you can trust, you know, who you can pick up the phone and say, hey, what's really going on here? Because one thing about that special study, all of us, for years thereafter, to this day, can call up people and say, what's going on? And you get the information. As far as I know, maybe leaving the Jerry Ray matter aside, I don't know of a single injunction or criminal matter that came out of my area, out of the commission. There was a big economic change and shift. Hopefully, it was for the better. Essentially, what has happened is that the distance, economic distance, between the buyer and seller has virtually disappeared. That's essentially what it's all about.
With the electronics.
Electronic and these rules knocking out the fixity of the right. of the difference between buyers and sellers. The middleman is the bridge, the toll taker. That's the investment banker, broker. And he would get a fee for it. So you enormously could raise the cost. You said, well, that's not all that important. But it did something else. It also, with respect to mutual funds, said, we're not going to distort the sale of this security by the compensation system, which permits enormous compensation to go to those who sell mutual funds. That is strategic development. You are, and that will lower the compensation for that particular form of investment. It therefore encourages the no-load fund. And it discourages massive growth where there might be very bad performance because the compensation system is so high. Now, you still have that problem with compensation systems in the securities industry, but it's not in the business of buying and selling securities. What it is it the compensation system for trading, where you get enormous compensation for taking leverage and risk. But that, again, is a subject which is not known much about, of how that compensation system works and whether or not, as I personally believe, it probably increases enormously the amount of risk taking. Because that's why you make $30 million a year.
Right.
But on the other hand, people will say, not a public company, doesn't matter. But they are public companies now. That's another development.
Somebody's always going to pay anyway.
Right.
Well, I think this is probably a great place to wrap up.
Okay.
I really appreciate talking
to you. Thank you.
I feel like I've been through a seminar.
Well, by the way.
Oh,
that was one final point. As you may or may not know, Mike Eisenberg and I, for a while, then I alone, taught law at GW, securities market regulation. While all this was going on, these would be my final exam questions to the students. You're the president of the New York Stock Exchange. How would you defend yourself against the following? Or what would you do if you were a mutual fund director and you had these kind of pressures? What would you do? Would you sue if you were a third market maker? Who would you sue? So all of this for 10 years, 5 years, were the final exam questions for the law students. when I was teaching law. And it was essentially all these public policy issues. So at one point that we get publicized in the newspapers, here's Gene's final exam for the New York Stock Exchange directors.
Yeah.
And so
I wonder if they ever guessed better than the directors.
Well, I once sent them, I think the president of the New York Stock Exchange, the best exam answer. So it was good public service, and I got the bug, and that's why I went to the bank.
Well, terrific. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.